Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for December the 2nd, 2018, the first Sunday of the final month of the year. Welcome to our weekly look at the world of politics and policy as we go from City Hall to the State House and all the way to the White House. So, time to grab that Sunday paper, get that hot cup of coffee, and we'll do our best to get your week off to a great start. Well, Dave, I got to tell you, it's not too bad outside.
No,
right now,
it, you know? When I left this morning to come in, I walked outside and I thought, boy, this is rather balmy, isn't it?
Well, I had my winter coat actually felt warm walking over.
I know.
Here.
Yeah. Yeah. Same here. We're 40 at O'Hare, 44 at Midway, and 46 along the lake. You and I were commenting on those temperatures here in the newsroom a little while ago. And it is unusual, and certainly unusual for tornadoes. December 1st, there were 12 reported such tornadoes in central Illinois yesterday.
Yeah, I'm thinking of my friends down there in Taylorville. And Beardstown. I think Girard also had some tornadic activity. Springfield Airport reported a wind gust of 74 miles an hour. That's the record for December, was 72. But Taylorville, yeah, the pictures from some of my friends down there, damage reports are not good. Thankfully, latest word that I have is no fatalities.
That's correct. 30 injuries, but...
Right. There is one serious injury, I believe, and that person's was transferred to Springfield. But we're thinking about everybody there and texted a couple of friends from down in the Springfield area yesterday, and when we get information about support and helping folks out there, we'll be putting it up on our Facebook and WGN website. So, but yeah, our thoughts and best wishes to everybody down in Taylorville, especially, which, again, those pictures were just unbelievable. And even the pictures, and this was like, you know, 3:30 in the afternoon.
They were supposed to have a Christmas parade right in Taylorville, and the mayor said, fortunately, that everybody was able to get out of the way and into some sort of shelter or safety prior to the worst of it.
Yeah, and the pictures were just so stark and dramatic of the funnel clouds coming down.
I know, yeah, yeah. There's things on YouTube also that I've seen.
Yeah, I mean, and it's December. And I mean, but that shows the power of that weather front that was moving through down there, too.
And the mix of, you know, always with warm and cold air. But, yeah, when that front came through and it hit, same thing that we get in the spring and the summer when you get a mix of hot and cold air. Only this time it's December, not May.
Right.
So.
Again, our thoughts are with everybody down in central Illinois. I tried to stay up for that game last night, and I made it. I made it through the third quarter when things were looking up.
Yeah.
And the Cats, I mean, it was a great game. It was a great game to watch.
Yeah, it was entertaining for sure. You thought at 24-7 at the half, it might get away.
Right.
But, you know, give Northwestern a lot of credit. Give Clayton Thorson a ton of credit as well.
Oh, absolutely.
Coming back two straight scores. Making it a three-point game, but man, Dwayne Haskins, that guy was all over the field. And you know what? It was sad too, because there was a couple of times where the defenders really had him hemmed in, and he would be able to escape to his right and make a bullet pass. There was one in particular where he ended up throwing a touchdown pass that he escaped not one but two Wildcat defenders in the backfield and still made the play. He threw for 499 yards and five scores.
Yeah, just unbelievable.
I mean, give the guy the Heisman right now.
Right. I mean, it was kind of frustrating to watch because of the way he was able to get away, constantly able to get away.
Yeah, it was, you know, and for Ohio State, it was obviously a very tumultuous season with with everything that went on before the year started, and Urban Meyer being suspended for a couple of games, the cupcake games, though, early in the year. But, you know, they only lost one game. I mean, that's it. I mean, and it may end up hurting them because...
Well, I was going to say, have you got your final four pick?
Yeah, I'm going with the obvious ones. It would Alabama, Clemson, and Notre Dame. And I'm thinking that Oklahoma, by winning the Big 12 yesterday, is going to get in.
I have to agree.
Yeah, there's a lot of people making a case for Georgia. Georgia with two losses, but they lost to then number 13 LSU at LSU, and then they lose yesterday in a real close game. Where frankly, I think their coach blew it for them, going for a fake field goal or a fake punt that is with the score tied late, and gave Alabama a wide open door to bust through, and they did.
And again, that was an entertaining game.
That was a great game. Yeah, 35-28.
Yeah, that was about everything you'd expect it to be.
Yeah.
I can't see Georgia getting the right there.
Yeah, and a lot of people are making a case for Ohio State too. I mean, they think that they showed enough in the win against Northwestern. There were a few folks that were clamoring that Ohio State really needed to blow out Northwestern in order to be really taken seriously as a number four team. I don't think they did. I think Northwestern really hung with them. And
that's not a blowout.
I don't think that was a blowout by any stretch.
No. I'll be very curious to see all of the post-mortem on the when the final four picks are made here.
Yeah, that's coming out later this morning, too.
Right.
Just before noon here in Chicago. So we'll certainly stay on top of that. And now we just kind of wait and find out where the Cats go bowling. There's been a lot of talk about San Diego and the Holiday Bowl, but that's not official yet.
Well, they certainly are deserving of a bowl. That's for, I mean, it's a great season. Absolutely.
Cats.
Great season.
And, you know, Pat Fitzgerald, what he's meant to this team and what he's meant to this program, and not only as just a head coach, but also as a player, this is going to be the 14th bowl game that involves Pat Fitzgerald, either as a head coach, assistant coach, or a player.
Huh.
This will be the ninth as a head coach.
Wow.
Think about where Northwestern has come from.
Well, exactly.
You know?
Exactly. It was an afterthought.
And it started with Randy Walker and Gary Barnett a little bit before that. But Randy Walker really was the guy that really was the architect of finding the right quarterback for an offense. And it's really continued from there.
No, it's been so great to really see that program totally mature into the big time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah, it was Big Ten, but it was in big time, and it's big time right now.
It is.
That's for sure. What do we think about the Bears today?
I think the Bears get a win today. I think even with Chase Daniel probably making the start, you know, think about what he did against the Lions without any such practice. It was basically a walkthrough that he went through, and that was about it. Now he's had a full week of practice. The Bears have had some rest after that crazy stretch of three games in 12 days. It seems like they haven't played in a month, but it was only Thanksgiving Day is the last time that they played. And the Giants are hurting. They're not the same team. Eli Manning's not the same quarterback he was a few years ago, but there are a couple of guys to watch for. You know, Saquon Barkley, the former Penn State running back, is doing some good things for them. And, of course, Odell Beckham Jr., the talented wide receiver, will be someone to be reckoned with, but I think that the Bears will handle their business.
And then it's a week from tonight at Soldier Field.
Yep, against the Rams.
That's
a measuring stick. I mean, that certainly is a measuring stick for what this team is. You know, we thought about the Vikings game. Will they be for real? Are they for real? More people taking the Bears seriously, or more seriously, that is, after that win over the Vikings on Sunday night. But this will certainly be a little bit above that.
Yeah, because everybody still has the Bears like in a second tier,
mm-hmm.
even though they're leading the division.
Right,
they're like a second tier afterthought.
Yeah, they only have one more loss than the Saints now.
Right.
No, the Saints,
which
are
10-2. That was a surprise.
That was a crazy game.
Yeah, very surprising. All kinds of football, and I'm going to let this go. We're not going to talk about the Blackhawks.
That's okay. I mean, the only thing you can take out of that one from last night. Obviously, they gave up four goals in the first period. Duncan Keith went ballistic.
How many games have we given up
Oh, it's
3 or 4 goals in the first period.
Yeah, and the Hawks have the worst, I believe I've read this this morning, that it's the worst goal differential in the league at this point.
Which is ridiculous.
Which is something that they never, never had. And you know what? Everybody wants to look at the goaltending. Forget about that. It's defense.
It's blow up the defense.
It's defense.
I'm sorry. I'm not putting this on Corey.
No. Or even Cam Ward had no chance on a couple of goals last night.
No, I'm not putting it on them. I think it's time you just have to blow up the D.
Yeah, but the one thing I will say about last night's game that really impressed me and impressed Duncan Keith as he was being ejected for doing a WWE move on an official after he thought a boarding call should have been made and he went seeking retribution. Mm. The one guy that jumped in at his defense was one of the smallest guys on the ice, and that's Alex DeBrincat. He took on a guy that he was giving 5 inches and probably 30 or 40 pounds to defend his teammate after what they thought was a bad hit
right.
that wasn't called. And Duncan Keith even said after the game, he said, I'm not going to forget that.
I like the cat.
Yeah.
I really do. I really do. I just don't, other than blowing up the D, I don't know what the answer is.
Yeah, I think that has a lot to do with it. And I think some people are saying, well, it's the new style, that it's the man-to-man. It's not the zone anymore with Coach Q. Colleton likes to right. pressure the puck and pressure the man. Yeah, I just think it's really starting to show, unfortunately, is, you know, guys are getting older.
Right.
It's just a fact of, you know, when they get older, their skills diminish just a tiny bit. They can't do as much as they used to do. I mean, take nothing away from what Duncan Keith has accomplished in his career. A Conn Smythe Trophy winner and 2-time Norris guy and Brent Seabrook, his partner for a long time. I mean, they're just getting a little slower, and it's harder to, you know, it's hard to see, you know, because you remember them in their heydays. But, you know, that happens. It does happen.
And it's a fast game.
Yeah,
it is
yeah,
a very
absolutely.
Fast
absolutely. It's
game.
Getting faster.
Yes. I mean, just the technology has yeah. made things different.
And
I mean,
teams are scheming that way. Team, you know,
of course.
It used to be, I remember the old days of the New Jersey Devils with the neutral zone trap. I mean, everybody,
right.
was, the game just slowed down to
oh,
a pace where
awful.
You couldn't watch it. And, you know, now they take away the red line, no two-line passes, and teams are playing more defense, more physical defense, but they're letting you get at least through the center of the ice.
Right, right, right. Well, I mean, I'm still a Hawks fan.
Oh, me too.
Diehard Hawks fan.
Me too.
I just hope they figure things out here because they're a better team than what they're showing.
Yes, they are.
That's I think that's probably my frustration.
Yeah, right, a lot of talent still on that team.
Well, Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news. Andy has the latest sports. Producer Kassira is fielding your calls at 312-981-7200. You can text us at that same number, 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. And we're on Twitter at @SundaySpin. Engineer Bob is getting the newsroom Zamboni ready for the next round of cold air. Remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNRadio.com, and you can also get our podcast at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Up ahead in the show, after the 7:30 news, we'll speak to Paris Schutz. He's correspondent, anchor, segment host, jack of all trades at WTTW Channel 11. We'll talk about the law enforcement raid on Ed Burke's offices, as well as the filings for Chicago mayor. We'll get more news at the top of the hour, and then we'll speak to Brian Mackey. Brian's the Statehouse Bureau Chief for NPR Illinois and its Illinois member stations. We'll be talking about the recently adjourned fall veto session, which became a little bit heated at times. Then we'll get a final check of the news and sports at 8:30, and then we'll speak to State Senator Toy Hutchinson, a Democrat from Olympia Fields. She is the president of the National Conference of State Legislatures, and she was recently named by Governing Magazine as one of its 10 public officials of the year. That's all up ahead. Obviously, the news about the death of President George H.W. Bush at the age of 94. And, you know, everybody's got their kind of Bush story that does this business. And I remember at the age of 21, I'm still at SIU Edwardsville, going to school there, but also working part-time at the a long defunct Metro East Journal. And this was during the 1979-1980 campaign where Bush was running for president against then Ronald Reagan for the nomination. And he stopped into Belleville, Illinois on a Sunday afternoon to have had a fundraiser and then a news conference. And it was a Sunday afternoon, Belleville right across the river from St. Louis. St. Louis TV stations sent cameras, but they didn't send any reporters. I was the only reporter that was there. And I said to Mr. Bush, I said, would you mind if we talked afterwards so I'm not doing the work for the TV stations? He said, sure, we can do that. So he gave a brief spiel, TV cameras packed up, and he said, why don't we go sit down at the bar? I said, sure, but I'd like to go to the bathroom first. He goes, yeah, it's a good idea. We both walk into the bathroom together. We're at adjoining stalls, and the future president of the United States turns over to me and goes, son, can I ask you how you ever got in such a crappy profession? And I said, well, Mr. Bush, I suppose I could ask you the same thing. And he goes, that's a good answer. He goes, let's go sit down at the bar and talk. And we talked for about 45 minutes. You know, people talked a lot about when Hillary Clinton was running about most qualified person ever to run for presidency of the United States. That was one of the things her supporters said. You look at the background of George H.W. Bush, naval pilot, war hero, shot down. Although, according to some people, that doesn't make him a hero. Congressman, head of the Republican National Committee, first U.S. envoy to China, the head of Central Intelligence, vice president and president, a life very well lived. President George H.W. Bush. We'll be back with more right after this.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. The president arrived back from Argentina to the White House just a few hours ago. Been a busy, busy week in Washington. Politics not taking a holiday, and neither does Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into the Russian activities involving the 2016 election. You have President Trump's longtime attorney, Michael Cohen, taking a plea deal last week from Mueller, and that's about not telling the truth to congressional investigators about potential business interests of the president in Russia. Then you've got Paul Manafort, Trump's former campaign manager, who Mueller now says lied to his investigators. Trump continues denying any business activity in Russia, although he said, well, there might have been some light activity, whatever that means. He's tweaking all kinds of these statements. Before he left for Argentina to the G20 summit, Trump had no kind words to say about his former fixer, Michael Cohen.
He was given a fairly long jail sentence, and he's a weak person. And by being weak, unlike other people that you watch, he's a weak person. And what he's trying to do is get a reduced sentence. So he's lying about a project that everybody knew about. I mean, we were very open with it. We were thinking about building a building. I guess we had in a form. It was an option. I don't know what you'd call it. I decided ultimately not to do it. There would have been nothing wrong if I did do it. If I did do it, there would have been nothing wrong. That was my business.
That was his business, even though he said he had no business involving Russia. Last Sunday, a week ago, one of Trump's biggest defenders, attorney Alan Dershowitz, he was on ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos. And now keep in mind, this was even before the news of Cohen and Manafort, when he talked about how he viewed that Mueller's report will be politically devastating for Trump.
I think the report is going to be devastating to the president. And I know that the president's team is already working on a response to the report. And so at some point, when the report's made public, and that's a very hard question, considering the new attorney general, who has the authority to decide when and under what circumstance to make it public. It will be made public probably with a response alongside. The president will say, ah, look, it's political. There's their account and there's our account.
And that's Alan Dershowitz. So who knows when this report is going to come out, because the news just keeps growing with the Mueller investigation. Well, joining me now here in the Allstate Skyline studio is a good friend of the program, a good friend of mine, Paris Schutz from Channel 11, WTTW. I don't even know what titles to give you. I mean, you're like everybody these days. They like if it were business cards, you know, you would need the entire, you know, wallet to fill it.
I just go with Chicago Tonight broadcaster.
Broadcaster, okay.
Like you,
okay, yeah. Broadcaster.
But
okay.
But we're journalists, so I mean, and right. there's a weight with that word, so I don't want to dismiss that word too.
Yeah, because I mean,
because everyone loves journalists now. So,
my fellow enemy of the people, yeah. Here. Well, and I want Paris to come on because this has been a kind of an extraordinary week in Chicago politics, going back to Monday being the last day of filing for candidacies for mayor, aldermanic positions. But, you know, 21 candidates filing for mayor, not all of them real, obviously. But then you take that as the start of the week, and then you finish out the week with Thursday with brown paper covering the windows of the City Hall office of the Dean of the City Council, Ed Burke. And we still really don't know what this is about.
No, we don't. But I think we can confidently say we know what it's not about. And that is the Mueller investigation and Donald Trump, given Burke's work as Trump's tax appeal attorney for about 10 years.
Which I have to say, you know, kind of some of the national outlets went with
it
that.
It was interesting.
And it bugged me because that's that kind of flyover,
right.
Drive-by journalism.
It is. And they took no sort of care to sort of get to know what the story was about or who Ed Burke is. But I guess Ed Burke is only interesting to a national audience, I think, because of his relationship to Donald Trump. But I think we know just from sources that this is not related to his work with Donald Trump. It has nothing to do with the Mueller investigation. It has everything to do with his role as alderman and chairman of the Finance Committee and the various political committees that he controls. We still don't know specifically what they have on him.
No, but, I mean, for example, the law office.
Right. It was not raided.
It was not raided. So that ostensibly would be where the files would be about the
Trump
reassessment
Tower.
Of Trump Tower.
Right,
okay?
Right.
And then I do believe the U.S. Attorney's Office here in Chicago said that it was not based upon a request from Robert Mueller's actions.
Right, right, right.
But beyond that, here again, so we know the City Hall office gets raided. We know that his 14th Ward office gets raided. It's got to be something about his official duties.
It has to be something about his official duties. And even if nothing comes of this, because I don't think an indictment is going to come tomorrow, although, you know, you never know. But the fact that they went in 90 days before an election tells you that there's something serious here that they felt that they couldn't wait on, because you saw the reaction from other aldermen saying typically the feds don't want to influence an election. They don't want any kind of perception that they're involved in any kind of election influencing. But the fact that they went in, and the images are indelible, like you said, papering up the wall, walking out with computers and files of paper, this does not look good. And the fact that it's 90 days before an election means they felt that something was imminent and a federal judge, you know, okayed their warrant to go in and do this. This is not something that is going to be sort of, you know, taken lightly, I don't think.
Well, and the fact that, I mean, there are ways to conduct investigations, and the fact that this was such a highly visible action versus, you know, a subpoena of records or those kinds of things where it's more of a paper, you know, email kind of
thing. Right, yeah, you almost wonder if the feds wanted those images of the camera crews capturing them walking out. I mean, this was like watching, you know, Law and Order or CSI or some great political corruption movie. I mean, this had it all. And this is the most powerful member of City Council, 50 years on the council, who's had his run-ins with the feds before. I mean, 2012, they subpoenaed the records related to the workers' workers' compensation program, which he runs without oversight, out of the Finance Committee of City Council, which is a bizarre thing. I mean, this is something that's unique to Chicago, where it's usually an HR function or an executive branch function. And you know, reading the tea leaves, I don't think this investigation has anything to do with that either. Which, you know, we don't know where that investigation is, but there's a lot of questions surrounding the $100 million workers' compensation payouts that he is in charge of.
Right, right.
So, but I reading the tea leaves, I don't think it's going to go there. I think there's something else that we just don't know about.
Right, but as you said, and I have to agree, it has to be something serious and potentially something that there's a need for immediacy in their action.
Yeah, you're right. They didn't just quietly subpoena records. No, they went right in. And he claims that he doesn't know anything about what they're looking for, and he's going to cooperate fully. And he kept repeating that, as I have in the past, I'm going to cooperate. Reminding everybody that he's been under federal investigation before for ghost payrolling, for the workers' compensation. So, you know, this is just fascinating.
Been there, done that.
He seemed pretty nonplussed about it, but this is different. Doesn't it feel different to you?
It does. And also, of course, it's also on the day that his wife, Ann Burke, is being sworn in.
That couldn't have been a coincidence either. I mean, they knew he wasn't going to be in the office.
Correct.
So and so it's kind of poetic, too. I mean, the feds sometimes are not want for irony, you know.
No, they don't like to make it. They don't like to use a flashing neon light to write it out. It's like, but you can
some
draw,
subtle little irony.
You can draw your own conclusions here, kind of thing. We're talking to Paris Schutz from WTTW Channel 11. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Good Sunday morning and welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson from the Chicago Tribune, joined here in the Allstate Skyline studio by my good friend Paris Schutz from WTTW Channel 11. We were talking about most recently the FBI raid on Ed Burke's offices. And, I mean, there's significant political impact here. I mean, one, you've got Burke, who probably is still running for re-election, but facing, you know, perhaps the political contest of his life in a ward that has rapidly changed, rapidly grown more Latino.
It's pretty much mostly Hispanic. And even before all this, you saw Ed Burke doing things I've never seen him do. He's going door to door. He's posting on Facebook in Spanish. You know, he's ramping up a full-fledged campaign. And the reason is, you know, Chuy Garcia, now congressman, who has kind of coalesced a lot of power in the progressive Latino community. Chuy Garcia was instrumental in knocking off Ed Burke's brother, who was a state legislator, Dan Burke, with a progressive Latino candidate, Aaron Ortiz. They made no bones that they were coming after Ed Burke next, and they are. And it's interesting what they're doing in this race. So Burke has four challengers in this race. Three of them have direct connections to Chuy Garcia. They worked for him in the county, or they worked on his campaign. And what's happening here is Garcia has put these three people with some of them have pretty interesting resumes out there to see, you know, who is going to be the one that can raise the most money, who's going to be the one that can withstand a petition challenge. So
rather than Chuy actually having to line up behind one person,
he's throwing three to the lions and say, you prove yourself to me.
And I'll be for whoever survives.
It seems like a good strategy, because if you just had one person, you know, Burke could find something and knock them off the ballot, and then you don't have anybody. So they've thought about this for a long time. So even before this raid, Ed Burke was going to be facing one heck of a re-election battle.
Now, you take on top of that, there's Burke's various connections with some of the mayoral candidates.
It's fascinating. Yeah. Well, you look at Gary Chico, who Burke endorsed. Gary Chico Burke is a mentor of mine. And then Susana Mendoza, who Burke helped get her start in public office. And on Susana Mendoza's website, it said that Burke was a mentor of hers. And then it went down. It said, error, this page is not available anymore. But then they put it back up because they thought it would look really silly if they obviously got rid of
it. It is what it is.
But then Tony Preckwinkle, you know, Tony Preckwinkle is now the head of the Cook County Democratic Party. And Ed Burke hosted a fundraiser for her recently as she ran unopposed for Cook County Board Chairman. So it's hard for a lot of these candidates to sort of get past their connections to Ed Burke. And I don't think they want to say anything. You know, they want to jump to any conclusions because ostensibly, if they do win, they are going to have to work with him. He can imperil their agenda if they get on his wrong side. So they're kind of taking a wait and see approach, except for Lori Lightfoot, who's saying, hey, this is all the machine politics that I'm running against.
Well, and I do think, you know, if you're running as the kind of the insurgent candidacy, and as we've seen in Democratic politics, obviously insurgents versus establishment or whatever, you know, Ed Burke is as establishment as you're going to get.
He's a picture of us, and he's wearing the pinstripe suit, and he's wearing the fedora, and, you know, as he comes home the other night, I mean, it's right out of central casting here. He doesn't even want to, you know, he doesn't even want to pretend that it's not what it is, old school machine right. politician.
But I mean, if you are running as an insurgent candidacy, he makes a target.
But
of course, with his longevity, he has tentacles in everybody that
judges. He made every judge in Cook County.
Every judge in Cook County, absolutely. I mean, that's his job. He's in charge of the judicial slating for the Cook County Democratic
Party. And through his running of the workers' compensation system, he's got a lot of foot soldiers he could use as precinct workers to help knock on doors and get out the vote. There are a lot of city workers in Chicago, as you know, that owe their jobs to him. So this is not unlike Mike Madigan, you know, an empire with tentacles spread everywhere.
And then there's the tax appeals business. On top of that,
and he's leveraged his position as a city council member to gain clients for his tax appeal business. So it's all. And then he runs three or four campaign funds worth $12 million.
It's an enterprise.
It's an enterprise, and who knows what part of that the FBI is really looking into.
Let's look at the mayor's race now. As I've mentioned, there were 21 people that filed. Not all of them are. I mean, now we're in the. I think we set off the
silly season.
It's the silly season, and it's about who's going to really be able to make it past a challenge, and I believe tomorrow is the start of the objection period.
Right. Yeah, we'll know who's going to get objected to tomorrow.
Right, which I would say probably everybody's. There'll be an objection filed. But this is the silly season where it really becomes the legal circus, and it's about irregularities in the candidacy petitions.
It's crazy. I mean, it could come down to you didn't bind the petitions correctly, you didn't notarize it correctly, the paper has an ink smudge on it. Campaigns are doing, you know, feverishly over the last several days is going through every single signature and saying, well, that's invalid, that person doesn't live there, that's not a registered voter, this looks like it was forged. And, you know, we've seen a lot of pages that other campaigns have sent out of Susana Mendoza's petitions, and they looked like they are not, you know, these are going to be signatures that are knocked off. You need 12,500. The interesting thing about her is she's kind of considered a front runner, and she only turned in about twice the required amount, which means, obviously, do the math, one out of every two signatures is going to have to be of a valid registered voter registered at that address that they signed, and that's going to be fraught. I think it's interesting that you saw Tony Preckwinkle show up with 60,000 and Amara Enya with 60,000. Who knows how many of those are good? I mean, they all have petition gatherers that went out and forged signatures and got paid and went home, and these are going to be thrown out. But when Mendoza only turned in about 25,000, it makes it very intriguing, and she will get a petition challenge probably from Tony Preckwinkle and more. And it could be a battle to just get her on the ballot.
Well, and I had forgotten that, unlike the state sets a maximum of two times the minimum.
You can get 10 times.
There is no maximum here. So
you have a
larger margin of error if you get, you know, a significant number.
Yeah, so Susana Mendoza's margin is smaller. Tony Preckwinkle's margin is a little larger. Dorothy Brown only had 25,000. I'm going to predict she's not going to make the ballot at all because, you know, we were being sent just entire pages where they were clearly forged. I mean, these were clearly fake names, fake signatures, not real addresses that showed up as empty lots. I don't know what her operation was thinking, but it doesn't seem likely she's going to make the final ballot.
Although she made the ballot before.
That she has, right, right.
And it takes somebody to challenge.
It does.
I mean, it's unless there's some prima facie evidence.
Yeah, like, and it costs
like
money.
You only filed 80 signatures,
right,
or whatever.
Another campaign has to challenge. And the conventional wisdom, Tony Preckwinkle, it's like there's so many people in this race, and they want to challenge the other people that are in their lanes.
Right.
So Tony Preckwinkle probably wants to challenge, you hate to make this about race, but other African-Americans who could take the African-American vote away from her, because she's going to rely on that. As part of her coalition, African Americans, I think public employee unions, the Lakefront Liberal, the old Harold Washington coalition. So and you look at Paul Vallis and Gary McCarthy and Bill Daley, they kind of occupy a similar lane.
Right.
So they might, you know, try to maneuver to sort of hit at each other. So if you're Paul Vallis, you don't want Gary McCarthy in there. You want to go after the more maybe moderate or conservative white working class Northwest Side, Southwest Side Chicagoan.
This is all what's ahead.
It's all what's ahead. It's going to be a fascinating week. Seems like people are really interested in sort of the machinations here, because this is a race, as you would know better than anybody, Rick, that, I mean, this is the kind of thing we haven't seen in 35 years. You know, Daley was like deigned every year. Rahm Emanuel, there's pretty much no doubt, you know, when he came in, it was, you know, he had more money and power and establishment backing than anybody. And right now, it's just anybody's game.
It is anybody's game.
And same for the city council. I mean, there aren't that many contested races, but there are enough to see significant turnover.
Absolutely. And maybe shake things up in a way that we haven't seen.
Well, you have people that are even discussing now, like, what are the new coalitions going to be?
Correct.
The Progressive Caucus, are they going to join up with some of the people that used to support Rahm and Daley and start a new caucus? The Latino caucus or the African-American caucus. You have a lot of people that were not very active on city council because they just kind of let Rahm and Daley do their thing, and they kind of put their heads down and focused on their ward and voted the way Rahm and Daley wanted. And now all bets are off.
And now they got to show something for
them. They do.
Para Schutz from WTTW Channel 11, thank you so much for joining me here in studio this
You're the
morning.
Best, Rick. I would only do it for you. Actually, I'd do it for anybody, but especially
now,
for you.
Yeah, except now I know how this works. I know I got an OMI coming.
All right, yeah, you're going to see Rick on the Weekend Review on WTTW pretty soon.
Thank you, Paris.
All right, no problem.
Now the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio. Wanted to talk about the end of the fall veto session, which ended in Springfield. It ended with dozens of Governor Rauner's vetoes being overridden by lawmakers. And during debate on one measure aimed at increasing damage awards for victims of the Legionnaires' disease outbreaks at that Quincy Veterans Home. Well, the debate got very heated. Democratic Representative Stephanie Kifowit of Oswego issued a threat to Republican Representative Peter Breen of Lombard.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the representative from Lombard, I would like to make him a broth of Legionella and pump it into the water system of his loved one so that they can be infected, they can be mistreated, they can sit and suffer by getting aspirin instead of being properly treated, and ultimately die.
Yeah, that's Democratic State Representative Stephanie Kifowit of Oswego, who at first denied saying that. You just heard it. Then she basically said that she was misheard, misrepresented, misinterpreted, and mischaracterized. Folks, you just heard it. I don't know. It sounds pretty clear to me. The next day, she did apologize to Breen and had her remarks stricken from the record. But you heard them. They may strike them from the official record of the Illinois General Assembly. You heard them. They're on the tape. That's above and beyond the pale. And quite frankly, this is a bill that got 79 votes when it first passed the General Assembly in the House. You need 71 to override. It should have gotten 79 votes, even more. It got 71. And it got 71 because of her remarks. beyond the pale. Sorry, that's my opinion. Brian Mackey, Statehouse and political correspondent for NPR Illinois. Brian, thanks for joining me this morning.
Good to be with you, Rick.
So I don't know if you heard, I just played the Stephanie Kifowit remarks. And I appreciate people being passionate about issues and those kinds of things. But you don't ask for somebody to die.
I think there's a way, if you want to give the most generous interpretation of that, it's what she said, she thought she said, right? So as you pointed out, she came on the mic shortly later in that day's session and said that she was misheard and she would never say wish death on someone. She said, you know, imagine what it would be like if this was your relative. And I think that's, I mean, if you want to be generous about it, you can say that's probably what she intended, but it's clearly not what the tape shows she said. And I think that her decision to not sort of own up to it and say, you know, I misspoke, it was a moment of passion or something like that, that's what extended this story for another day and you know, eventually got it some national attention. I think it also, you have to consider the context in which it comes. Republicans have just been, and Democrats, but Democrats had such a money advantage this year. The Republicans feel like they were really battered in the election. And, you know, the ads that the House Democrats in particular are kind of notorious for using make these connections where if you don't vote for the budget and the budget funds rape crisis centers,
then there's going
to be an ad that you support rapists or something like that. Or you want to kick women who have been sexually assaulted out on the street. And I think that in that context, as the Republicans were trying to say, it just shows that, you know, this sort of really nasty campaigning that's happening is seeping into the actual legislative debates.
Yeah, except, I mean, I have to tell you, I mean, I've heard some caustic remarks on the floor. I've seen near fist fights or even kind of a punch thrown every once in a while. I've never heard anybody wish somebody died. And, I mean, yes, she made her apology. And I'm not clutching any pearls here, okay? I've been doing this a long time. I just thought that was the most insensitive remark that I've ever heard in covering the General Assembly for 35 years. And you can say all you want about, well, I meant to say this, I meant to say that. I'm sorry. Words are our trade.
Sure.
And you know, and I'm not even, you know, some people were trying to say, oh, well, this is because of the Trump era or whatever. It does. That's got nothing to do with it. But it is a sign of that, I think, the fact that civility is just virtually gone out the window.
Right, and this idea that if you disagree, you know, if we take a step back...
If you disagree, you should die. I mean...
If you take a step back and remember what this legislation was about,
right.
It was increasing the amount of money you can get if you need to, you know, quote-unquote, sue the state. You can't actually sue the state in court, because the state has made itself immune from that, but you have to go to this other body called the Court of Claims, and until this legislation passed, you were limited to getting $100,000 in damages. That number was set in the early 1970s. If you adjust it, if you had adjusted it for inflation, today that amount would be worth between $600,000 and $700,000. And the legislators, mostly Democrats who pushed this legislation, decided to raise that amount to $2 million. Now, the governor and other Republicans say that's not a great idea. You're inviting more lawsuits for the state. So there is a substantive policy debate to be had here. But because this issue is also tied up with the Quincy Veterans Home, and that's sort of what the sponsors use to say, look, there are these families out there. They've lost their loved one. They're not going to be able to get anywhere near the amount of compensation they should under the old law. We need to raise that amount. But they didn't just raise it for those, you know, sort of particular claims.
Right.
They raised it for everyone. And so that's the public policy discussion. But then to take that leap into such passionate territory, I mean, that is a reasonable, that seems like a very well within the realm of reasonable things that people can reasonably disagree on. But you're right, to take that and say, as... you know, Kifowit did, your family should die, and as other people did, you know, well, then you don't care about veterans, you're betraying our veterans. It's this escalation that is that seems to be infecting all of our politics.
And, as I said, very well could have cost the veto override. that she so desperately
wanted.
It seems
like it was very
close. So, we're speaking with Brian Mackey, State House and political correspondent for NPR Illinois. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. We were talking earlier about the end of the veto session, and Republican Governor Bruce Rauner made a rare public appearance, taking questions from reporters for the first time since losing to J.B. Pritzker on November 6th. When Rauner was asked why he thought he lost, he instead deflected into an attack on the Democrats who will control Illinois state government.
I'll say this about the election. I'm very scared for the people of Illinois. I believe that the folks who put Illinois into a financial quagmire are now back in complete control of the government. The policies that have created the financial mess for the state of Illinois are now the policies that will be dominating completely without any resistance whatsoever in the state going forward. I think deficit spending, tax increasing, over-regulating, self-dealing, the things that have gotten us in a mess are now going to be dominant with no voice pushing back.
That's Republican Governor Bruce Rauner. Joining me now on the phone is Democratic State Senator Toy Hutchison from Olympia Fields. She is the president of the National Conference of State Legislatures and also was named by Governing Magazine as one of the top 10 public officials in the country. Senator, congratulations.
Thank you so much. Good morning.
Good morning. So you heard the governor's comments. You're part of the expanded Democratic majority in the Senate, expanded Democratic majority going on in the House, Democrats capturing all statewide offices. What's your take on outgoing Governor Rauner's remarks there?
I think it's unfortunate. We hear a lot of public officials across the country talk about how we need to do better in the way we communicate to and about each other. And one thing I do know, visiting states and places around the country and frankly around the world, is how much people are concerned about the fact that we talk about the institutions that are supposed to govern us in ways that almost make it impossible for anybody to trust or understand anything. And that does a disservice to every single constituent we have. So in a time when the success of whoever is in that office means the success of the state of Illinois, I would hope that he would have just done better. He called for that at the end of the campaign, but those comments are pretty much exactly what he was saying over a 736-day impasse where he couldn't figure out how to talk to anybody. So, I'm sorry that that's the tact he chooses to take on the way out. That's just really unfortunate. We have lots of work to do, and I'm really looking forward to a different approach to how we do it. And I think you'll see that just based on the number of people who are on transition teams, the breadth of folks that are coming in to give their help and service and ideas, the fact that our incoming governor, governor-elect Pritzker, didn't hold the line on we only want to hear from just Democrats. He broadened the tent and expanded it to people all across the political spectrum, and that's the way you govern. At some point, you got to stop campaigning, because you can't govern if you never stop campaigning.
Well, I was almost thinking in here with former President George H.W. Bush and his passing, and a lot of people are commenting on the note that he left Bill Clinton in the White House, and, good luck. You're all our president now. And to contrast it with
saying, I'm rooting for you hard, that right. I want you to succeed so the country succeeds. It's a case study in classiness that I think we're missing from the political system today.
Well, now you've been president of NCSL since August. It's a big organization. Obviously a lot of traveling around to other states. And what kind of things are you learning from other states as you hold this position?
I don't know whether this is funny or not, but really the biggest thing that you see once you get to travel everywhere is that nobody's happy.
Really?
I've never been to a state where anyone in that individual state is singing all the praises in the world about their political system. Everybody's upset about something. And you can almost point to some of the arguments that we have here anywhere else you go. And sometimes it's regional, sometimes it's near borders, sometimes it is partisan, absolutely ideological partisan divides. But the one thing you do see is that we desperately need to protect and strengthen the institution of the legislature, that the legislative branch is an Article I branch. It was contemplated to be closest to the people, and that would be where the seat of governing, that would be where the seat of governing would happen. And now we have an environment where people literally run against the institution. So if you hate it when you run for it and then you get in and say, oh no, but not me. We have to do much better to make sure that people understand that the people they send to Springfield or to D.C. are there to participate in something that really does make our country great, and that's representative democracy. We can't do that when we're literally tearing down the institutions that are charged with keeping us all, not necessarily on the same page, but governs how we live and work and play together. So the eye-opener, really, is that we have a lot of work to do to restore trust. Otherwise, none of the work that any of us runs on can happen.
So how do you restore that trust, though? You can't do it in this atmosphere.
Well, you know, part of it is you have to, it may sound quaint, but being the change you want to see. So even we just opened this segment on what did I think about Governor Rauner's remarks. And contradicting those to what we've seen in the majority of the history of our country, which is a smooth transference of power. It's something that we are known for globally, which is being slowly eradicated every single day. So we have to model that. When any of us that are in the public eye and in the public trust this way, we have to model that. It doesn't mean you have to be saints or perfect. You should never make mistakes. But it does mean that you hold the position that we hold in a sense of, I have a responsibility to the people that I represent to be as transparent, as open as I possibly can. And that also means accepting and acknowledging that people who disagree with me aren't necessarily evil per se. They just disagree with me. And that means I have to work harder to at least see whether we can move the ball forward. That's really what representative democracy is about. It's what our system is about. Nobody has a claim on all the good ideas only on one side of the aisle, and it cannot ever work that way because all you get is gridlock at that point. And we see that everywhere. And the biggest thing I also see when I travel also internationally is how many people are so concerned about America losing its leadership position in the world on that point in particular. So it's been fascinating to explain, one, our federal system to people around the world, and then visit our own, you know, each other members of the legislature across the state, because NCSL is 7,400 legislators across the state, both Republican and Democrat, and over 25,000 legislative staff across the country. This is where we really are the little laboratories of democracy, and when we do well, the country sees it. We move the ball forward.
I'm not so sure I'd want to be in your position of trying to explain where we are as a government these days sometimes, you know, and that's got to be a very defensive position when you talk about where the state of affairs to someone in a foreign country.
Sometimes it's I have experienced those moments, but then I've also experienced incredible moments of, you know, being in places where I have to realize that they have a full, vibrant political spectrum just like we do, and that sometimes the rhetoric that I hear from their seats of power doesn't match what individual people feel across their country, you know, closer to the ground. And when you connect with someone like that anywhere in the world and you recognize that there are people who love democracy and understand that that is something that is built from the people. That's not top down. That is literally designed and built to be bottom up, and we have to right that. And the only way to do that is to talk to people who don't look like you, who don't think like you, who may not necessarily agree with you. I have a 92-year-old aunt who told me just a couple days ago, she said, you very rarely learn anything from somebody who agrees with you all the time. Pretty much only learn something from somebody who doesn't.
Very good point. We're speaking with State Senator Toy Hutchinson, Democrat from Olympia Fields, the president of the National Conference of State Legislatures. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, speaking with State Senator Toy Hutchinson, Democrat from Olympia Fields. She's the president of the National Conference of State Legislatures, and she was recently honored by Governing Magazine as one of 10 of the 2018 Public Officials of the Year. And, Senator, you were cited along with two other lawmakers, from one from Colorado and one from Indiana, as being an essential part of responding to the Me Too movement in the country. And I guess I'm wondering, you know, every day we hear about another instance of things, but have we done enough on the government side and also in the political campaign side to try to prevent this kind of harassment from going on?
This is a topic of conversation, I think, that we're all having, and I think we're having it in a better way than we had before. I know,
because we're talking about it, right?
I mean, exactly, and that goes to changing the culture that's around this, because a lot of this we won't be able to legislate away. I mean, we're talking about deeply seated behaviors and ways that we interact with each other that have a lot of different causes and come that are ingrained in, and sometimes there's generational differences, sometimes there's all kinds of intersections. This is complicated. This is not just we're going to pass a bill and all of a sudden it's going to be gone. Any more than I usually make the comment to a lot of my women friends when we're talking about being frustrated about the pace of this, is that I wake up every day and wish there wasn't any more racism, but there is. And you get up every day, and you do the best you can to make this better today than it was yesterday. So it's slow, and it's complicated, it's unwieldy, but it's necessary. And I think the fact that it's happening the way that it's happening is also extremely uncomfortable. And so when you get extremely uncomfortable, you also have the requisite backlash. So with all of that that's happening across every single industry, then you have these bills and things that pop up that I think give people light. The low-hanging fruit that we had was that sexual harassment in the building was not an express violation of the ethics code. So imagine that. Even if you had reported it, it wasn't an express violation. That was low-hanging fruit. It was low-hanging fruit to make sure we had a legislative inspector general. Most people didn't know we didn't have one.
Right.
Most people come into a building and don't recognize how many different layers there are that make up the atmosphere in the Capitol, people who are independently working, people who are independently working for other people on contract, folks who actually work for the state, and then the biggest thing, we the elected officials, and how do you hold folks like that accountable? There are a lot of places and ways and areas that people interact, but at the end of the day, in 2018, just because it's here and it's out in the open, you should never, nobody should ever go to work wherever they go to work, especially in the place, in the seat where laws are made, and feel unsafe.
I think that's the part of it that makes it hard to wrap around, is this is the place where the laws are made, and it happens. Well, we will talk more about this because obviously the discussion continues. Democratic State Senator Toy Hutchinson from Olympia Fields, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.